Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Tiger Bales and Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Morning, Amy. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
Had a good weekend.
It was nice and casual and laid back and not too too much pressure. It was good.
Yeah.
It was good. One thing I liked about the weekend was the Cowboys demolishing.
It was the best.
The Sharks. Wasn't that unbelievable?
I was screaming at the TV. Thurston played. Oh, he's deadly,
Him
eh?
And Michael Morgan.
I hope they win the premiership. I really do. I think they deserve it.
They do deserve it. And
I'll go against them. I'll go against Broncos for them, I reckon.
Oh, wow. All right.
Might get some angry callers into the studio today.
Good on you. No, I thought it was a quite fitting way for Michael Innes, who I think is a really bad sport, and Gallen,
Paul
who's a
Gallen.
Really bad sport.
Yeah.
I think it's a very fitting way for their demise for this season. To
and
go
I
out
actually
like
don't
that.
Know why they kept Benny Barber off so long, the Sharks.
Exactly.
But anyway,
yes.
That was their loss.
You've got to question that. Why did they keep him off for so long? That guy's always good for a four-pointer or two.
Yeah.
And setting them up and stuff. But that's footy. That's footy for us. You can see what we've been doing on a weekend. We watch the Cowboys. Okay, so we've got Alexis Wright, Amy?
Yeah, and I thought I'd just give our listeners a little bit of an intro to Alexis Wright. She's probably one of the best Australian writers in the country today, but she's a proud Aboriginal woman, and she's in a couple of years ago she won the Miles Franklin, which is our most prestigious literary award for her novel Carpentaria. She's written two books previously, Grog War, which was set in Tennant Creek about alcohol restrictions and the community's long fight to put in alcohol restrictions. Another work, Plains of Promise, and her recent work is The Swan Book. So I'm really excited to have Alexis. She's probably one of my favourite writers as well. Alexis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you very much. And hello, Tiger. And really... Really good to be on your program.
We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
I'm a bit nervous.
I'm a bit nervous talking to you, Alexis.
There you go, see? I'm not nervous about anything or anyone. That's all right. I've been around a bit longer, I suppose. Alexis, no, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time. You're, like Amy says, you're one of our foremost writers for First Nations people. You won the Miles Franklin. I mean, what was it like for you to be? How'd you feel when you were told that you're the winner for a Miles Franklin, the award here in the country, the highest? It'd be the highest literary award in the country, wouldn't it be?
It's I think at the time I just couldn't believe it, and I was quite happy to be on the long list. When they told me I was on the long list, I thought, oh, that's good. That's, I'm happy.
That's a long
that.
List, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah, and then when they said on the short list, I thought, well, yeah, gee.
Getting nervy here, yeah.
And when they told me that I won it, I didn't know what to think, so I went back to work and worked on my computer. The announcement was made publicly was the day that John Howard announced the intervention in the Northern Territory.
Same day. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and there was all this stuff on the media and from government people about conditions of Aboriginal people across the country and the really high failure in literacy and numeracy. And on the very day, an Aboriginal person won the Miles Franklin, their greatest literary award in the country. So that was
fantastic.
When was announced, the media immediately wanted to talk about the intervention, and So I talked about the intervention. I said it was, you know, what a bloody tragedy it was.
Tell us your mob, your country.
We're Wanyu people from the Gulf of Carpentaria, Southern Highlands, and around, you know, takes in Lorne Hills and across the territory.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Cloncurry,
okay.
Of all places.
You're Murray from Cloncurry.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, yep. Steve and Oliver.
Yeah.
He's from out there, isn't he? Murray from Cloncurry?
Yeah, the Oliver family. Ronnie Page, actually. I think penned that, the words to that song, you know, Murray from Cloncurry. And around about that time when, you know, I was in Mount Isa.
All right.
Our family were up in Lorne Hills. There's a big story there about what happened. And with, you know, family, like we all have big stories about, you know, what happened to our families.
Mm.
And we end up down in Cloncurry. Family spread from, you know, throughout Queensland. And
how'd you get to focus on writing, to be want to write? How'd you get to that point?
When I was I always credit my own mob for teaching me how to read and write. when I was a young woman, I was working in organisations in Mount Isa, legal service and housing, you know, organisation, alcohol rehabilitation. Spent some time up in Mornington Island during the time when Bjelke Peterson was wanting to take over Mornington Island and Aurukun. And I think an uncle of yours was in legal service at that time when it was a state body, Sam Watson.
Yes, that's right.
He used to come out to Mount Isa.
Mm.
And those amazing sort of days then. And I was quite young in those days, and a lot of times I was given the job, and you know, with a lot of people to do the reading and writing, because you know, a lot of our mom didn't have that, you know, bit extra education or that education at all, and I was just a young thing wanting to, you know, like we all were, wanting to. You know, save our world and why can't it be done today instead of tomorrow? they taught me patience and respect, and really I had to do all the minutes of meetings, take down every word that people said, and you know, do the letter writing, and we were fighting big issues as we're still fighting big issues today. And I really had to do a lot of reading and writing, because, you know, in particularly in Queensland, all our mob wanted, you know, us kids to do the work, and didn't want to, you know, bring in non-Indigenous people, or we didn't have the money anyway, and so we were doing the work, and in that. That was my university, really.
Right.
They
the
taught
issues
me to read and write and to think,
yes.
and be part of what was going on, and to really understand and try to understand. And I spent time on Mornington Island and travelling all around the place, you know, and some of those early days, and knew people like Fred Clay up, you know, was in Mount Isa.
Yeah.
And Oris, and
the issues that you refer to back in those days, and the issues today, they're still much the same, one and the same, still almost, isn't it?
Right. We seem to go backwards, instead of forward, and we had very little ability to get together. Although, you know, we got together for you know, protests and street marches and things down Brisbane. And other places.
I was just going to say, Alexis, when Tiger said the issues we're facing back then we're still facing today. It reminds me of the Swan Book because it's set in the future. To me, it was sort of like a work of science fiction but told differently. But it's pretty much saying the exact same things that are happening today. It's sort of an intervention going on. We've got all these problems with displacement, only that climate change is actually happening and displacing people, and you've got immigrants coming into Aboriginal lands actually. So even in the future, you envision that nothing much is going to change. We're still going to be grappling with a lot of these same issues.
Well, when I finished Carpentaria and started thinking about the Swan Book goes way back to, you know, when I started thinking about it to 2002, 2003. I was still living in Alice Springs at that time. And I was just wondering what was going to happen. I was actually thinking there's going to end up being army-controlled Aboriginal communities. I was thinking way back then. You know,
that was before the intervention.
Well, yeah, some years before the intervention, I was thinking that would happen, and it did happen. And while I was writing the book, also, you know, I thought if that's going, that sort of thing's going to happen, it's really hard to undo that, those sort of policies. And it took so long, you know, from, you know, the 60s and 70s to try and get some sense of, you know, what we were doing. And, we knew what we were doing. But dealing with different governments as they came in and talk about self-determination, the next minute self-management and something else. And and I just thought it's going to take years to unwind that. But then I thought if, you know, we continue having backward governments in Australia, what would happen, say, in 100 years' time? What will we look like? What will we be doing? How will the situation be? And I just felt that we just don't seem to have, you know, governments don't seem to have respect for us or respect for other people in the world who might need a hand. And the situation is getting worse rather than better, and as we're seeing, you know, and I was thinking about climate change and what could happen with climate change. We could end up having climate change wars where people are displaced by millions, and could end up with people, you know, living on the sea. You know, people who no country will take them; they're just pushed out, and we're kind of seeing that starting to happen, not through climate change, but through the war in the Middle East, and with all the, you know, Syrian people now, and, you know, trying to get cross borders in Europe by, you know, tens of thousands, you know, 500,000 people and more following.
That's fantastic that you're sort of looking forward and thinking about these things at this stage in your life, and now you're sort of seeing things happen. I mean, how do you feel when the sort of, I don't know, it's, how do you feel about that?
But, Tiger, you know, our people teach us that. Mm. People, are, you know, teach us to look forward.
Yeah.
This is the thing about, you know, Howard and the intervention that, you know, and all the criticism we got through the newspaper that we don't think about tomorrow, you know, the issues and, you know, where we're headed. We're not planning our future. So, oh, well, you know, the government should, you know, has to plan it for us and take over for us. And
so are we too busy sort of, or are we too focused on just bouncing from pillar to post? I mean, the lack of policy that's in place, and then the intervention sort of comes up and something else comes up and something else comes up, and we're dealing with these that we're reacting to rather than being proactive.
That's right. We take the burden on. Our burden,
yes.
just gets heavier. But when, you know, I lived in Central Australia for a really long time, was asked, in, you know, 1993 was, we had the Northern Territory Aboriginal Constitutional Convention. I might be wrong with my dates at the moment. But that was held in Tennant Creek, and I coordinated that for the the land councils in the Northern Territory and the legal services in the Northern Territory. And we brought it together, you know, over 1,000 people of our own mob, you know, from across Central Australia and other parts of the territory. Mm. And the convention was called, you know, Today We Talk About Tomorrow. And so we've always wanted to talk about tomorrow, but it's hard to bring people together like that. You know, we can only do that every now and again. And we've always been talking about our future and the future of our children. And that was the thing that we were accused of, you know, by the Howard government, that we don't think of our children. And I got my dates wrong. It might have been 1998, I think it was, yes. I coordinated a similar sort of convention in Kalkaringi for the Combined Aboriginal Nations of Central Australia. And that was to talk about, you know, the Northern Territory push to become a state in the Northern Territory.
All right.
And we were against that, and all the mob were against it. There was over 1,000 people again from Central Australia, and they came together and danced their stories and painted their stories and talked about, you know, the future. They wanted to bring all that culture into, they actually burnt the draft constitution for the Northern Territory to become the state.
Wow.
And right. Things like that,
yeah.
And danced at night, and that again, people were very much focused on the future, and didn't want a sort of future that the Shane Stone government in the Northern Territory was anticipating for Aboriginal people, which is to take over land rights in the Northern Territory, and any other sort of control that Aboriginal people had to fight really hard to try to get in the first place and try to maintain over many, many years.
No doubt a number of our mob across the country do think of the future. Mm. But thinking of the future, there's a need, from my own perspective on things, there needs to be more of us sitting around thinking, well, what sort of a future do we want?
Mm.
And putting things into place so that we get it. There's not a lot of that taking place, is there? Or maybe it is, but it's not on a broad scale where you're getting 1,000 people to do it.
No. Those sort of conventions were just one-off things that we were able to get a bit of money to do it.
Mm.
And the Combined Aboriginal Nations of Central Australia try to continue everything that came out of that convention in Kalkaringi with the Kalkaringi Statement. And then actually were successful in... there was a referendum not long afterwards in the Northern Territory about whether the Northern Territory should become a state or not. And we defeated that referendum by joining forces with all sorts of people, in fact, some very conservative parties in the Northern Territory who were also opposed with what the government was trying to do up there.
Would there not be a lot of relevance today with these sorts of discussions, the proposals, the positions? There'd be still a lot of relevance in this sort of stuff.
Well, it's going in circles because the NT are considering statehood.
That same thing now.
And now it's an Aboriginal chief minister who's pushing it. But there's no real talk around it, is there? So,
it's a basket case.
It really is.
Mm.
You know, with the type of government they've got there, it really is.
Mm.
It's they have no idea. And they can't afford to become a state, for one thing.
Mm.
Nice. But no, Toby, you're right. We do need to have more and more discussions and about you know, all the different ideas that are floating around from different people, but it's very hard to sort of bring people together and to do those things. And so when we do manage to have those kinds of meetings, everyone's dying to have a say, and meetings run over a couple of days, and we don't seem to be able to settle down and listen to, you know, and embrace all the views and work it out. You know, what is the plan for the future? What is our plan? You know, how do we get the story straight? Mm. And even though there's, you know, some really remarkable people in our mob who are really thinking about these issues and trying to, you know, take forward an agenda. Yeah.
Alexis, I was wondering what you think the role of Aboriginal storytelling is in sort of challenging a lot of the mainstream narratives, and what you see your role is particularly, because you've done stories in the past, for example, Grog War. But what do you see is the role of Aboriginal storytelling? And first, how do you define Aboriginal storytelling?
Well, I think we've always told stories. We come from a storytelling tradition, and I think that tradition is carried through and still carried through today with everybody, no matter where people are living, and stories are carried through. I tried to articulate that a little bit in an essay that I wrote for when Carpentaria was published, and looking at a book like Carpentaria, that you know, all times are important in our world, and no time has ever been resolved. And that's you know, idea from Carlos Fuentes, who is probably one of the greatest writers in Mexico, where he talked about Mexico in those terms, that all times are important, no time has ever been resolved in Mexico. And I saw that's really the same thing in our world. Nothing's been resolved, and we carry everything. You know, it seems like to me, felt to me at the time like a you know, multi-stranded helix of stories. You know, from the traditional to what's happened to us in recent times, and as we go forward, we carry everything, and. I think we do that, and I find that very much in the type of writing that I do, that, you know, I'm always, you know, trying to carry, you know, the culture, our beliefs, what we feel, and into whatever I do, as well as you know, the dispossession and everything else we've been through, and ideas that, you know, we're trying to grapple with for our own future.
It's a very non-Western way of dealing with it. I mean, when you look at Western literature, I guess it is all very focused on the individual, whereas Aboriginal literature is a lot different, isn't it?
That's right. And you know, where the country, our whole country becomes part. It's a family relationship that we have. You know, with you know, ourselves and with our beliefs, you know, what's in the country, the forces that are in the country, the stories of our traditional countries, and how we're all connected to one another, how those stories are connected. So it's you know, it's a family sort of relationship, and it's a kind of sacred relationship as well, that extends, you know, from those stories to us. To us and what we try to do in writing. Well, that's the way I'm, you know, I think about it, you know, for what I'm trying to do. And it's not a linear approach where that's, you know, you get criticism, oh, it's, you know, it's not linear, you know, it's not, you know, from here to there. It's not like that at all. It's everything combined and as one. And
are you often shocked by, or are you, how do Australian audiences view your work, and do you think that they are able to easily understand it?
I think they're trying to. I find that. The literary critics are trying to grapple with that, I was quite impressed with some of the reviews that Swan Book received in Australia from literary critics who really tried to understand what was going on. And a lot of people will find it difficult to read that style of writing, and they'll say so and say, "Oh, I had trouble reading this book, or I had to put it down." Or I would find people will either say they love it or they hate it, and nothing in between. So.
It's very similar to the way Australians deal with Aboriginal culture as well. If they can't understand it, they seem to just ignore it, or there's a great deal of ignorance about it because it's such a different way of thinking. I guess that's the same with your writing, and in the sense it's a completely different style for most Australians to become accustomed to.
Yes, and they might say, "Oh, that's just an Aboriginal person who's yeah. written a book." That's an Aboriginal activist, and they try to put it in a basket, and that's the way they'll try to understand it. And I would challenge that and say there's a lot more going on here, and a lot more going on in literature per se, than trying to put the work into those. In a basket, you know, they sort of simplified baskets. I talked recently about this issue at a seminar, a symposium in Sydney. I'm attached to in the Writing and Society Research Centre in the University of Western Sydney. And every couple of years we have a symposium with writers from China, and we do the same with writers from India as well, from across India or across China. And I talked about it this year in the talk that I gave, that we have trouble with people in English trying to translate our work. So we don't even know what's going on in foreign countries when our works are translated. And this is quite an issue, is trying to get people to understand our work, even in English, let alone translating in other countries.
We might take a break for a song and come back. You stay with us, you get a glass of water or something there while you wait. But our guest is Alexis Wright talking to us, a Miles Franklin Award winner, First Nations woman writer. And stay with us. Here's a song from Mornington. Alexis was talking about Mornington Island. She spent some time there. Here's a song from over there, Gunana.
The song there, Charlie Anderson, Gunana.
And that's from Mornington Island, is it?
It's Mornington. Gunan is a traditional name for Mornington Island, yeah.
I was just going to say, Alexis, I don't know if you probably know about it, but I'm pretty sure there's these old songs that they recorded from old fellas out Mornington Island, and they put it on the golden record that's on the Voyager spacecraft that just left the solar system. So if we ever contact aliens, they'll hear these ancient songs from Mornington Island. It's pretty amazing.
The best thing they could hear.
I know, I was thinking
they
that.
Might be walking around
probably the
them.
Oldest songs in the in history. I mean, they're the oldest continuing culture.
That's right.
So.
That's it.
Yeah.
By GA.
That's right. Just getting back to what you were just saying before, talking about with me before, Amy, is that the difficulty in kind of explaining or in translating or interpreting what's happening in our world is complicated, and our world is quite a there's a lot going on, and it is a very sophisticated a complicated world that comes from a very, very long tradition, from time immemorial, that we will say, and that's right, those older songs, and that's I put in a couple of lines in this beginning of Carpentaria, that you think you know our stories already, and that was what people would say, particularly about Aboriginal writing, oh, we know their stories already, and so. said, no, you don't. And if you think you do, read a book like this. And
do you think we have a duty to translate for English audiences or non-Indigenous audiences? Is that a duty that we hold?
To what?
To sort of translate, to provide that translation, do you think?
To write so they can understand. Is that what you're saying, Amy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To write so they can understand.
Yeah. I mean, what do you see? You're talking about it's very hard to translate these stories.
Yes.
Do you even see that we have a duty to do that? Or who are we writing for, I guess?
I'm writing for, I don't think I'm writing for our world, and I write for the best that I possibly can, and I'm testing myself when I'm writing, and so I'm trying to stretch boundaries and really challenge myself, and I guess in the type of challenges that I'm taking up, and that comes from my understanding and my experience and what people have tried to teach me, that I expect, and I'd like other people to take up the challenge as well, because I think we've got a long way to go in trying to get some understanding happening to what the Indigenous world is all about.
Yep.
And how sophisticated and knowledgeable it is. And because it comes from that great and a long tradition, one of the oldest culture in the world. So it's not easy to try to explain that, and that's the challenge, and that's the challenge for writing. That's a challenge that I would like to think that all Aboriginal people will take up if they're taking up the idea of writing.
But the challenge also for the non First Nations mob, there's a challenge there for them, rather than you catering to the needs and writing for them to understand or translate. There's a challenge there for them in your style of writing and the stories you write about, what have you. But there's a challenge for them, is there not, that they take it up and understand and work on understanding it. What do you say?
I think that's probably right, and books that I type, I try to write, they take a long time, in thinking about it, trying to imagine it, and in the craft of trying to write it, it takes a lot of thought and thinking with the ideas and really trying to build the structure of the work and to make it all work in the end. And so it takes me years to produce one book, and I'm trying to do. I could probably write quite far more easily, but that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to really challenge, what it is that we're, our understanding of ourselves.
Mm.
And it has a lot of power, doesn't it, Alexis? I was reading one of your recent addresses, I think you delivered in China. It was really interesting because it talked about how we lack sovereignty in so many areas in Australia, politically and economically, and we're always talking about sovereignty, but we already have this sovereignty of mind, and that's something you can sort of express through your writing, which I thought was really powerful, and it really speaks to how important words can be and storytelling can be. The fact we actually do have that sovereignty of our ideas. We shouldn't be curtailed by anyone, really, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's right, and that's that's been our greatest strength, and with all these different policies and things that get thrown at us, like the intervention in Northern Territory. It hasn't changed the way people think about themselves.
Your writing. Go on, keep going.
Yeah. I'm just talking about, in the way we think about ourselves, it hasn't changed. They keep trying to, that's the last thing they're trying to destroy. They take the land, they take everything else, and take our power, but they can't change our mind.
Yes, yes.
And that's the sovereignty of the mind.
With your writing, to get it published? I mean, do you have trouble getting published? Do you work with publishers beforehand? Have you got ideas that you want to put down on paper or in the form of a book before the publishers are even considered? I'm just recalling different people's experiences and trying to get their work published. Mm. How's it been with you?
Oh, it's had its challenges, put it that way, Tiger. Plains of Promise, it got published quite easily by UQP because they were very supportive of Indigenous writing. And the Grogwell book, Jalala Curry Council in Tennant Creek wanted me to write that book. And so I wrote it for them, and Mugabala, you were happy to publish it. And I did a book on essays and stories to celebrate, I think it was 25 years of land rights in the Northern Territory for Central Land Council, and IAD, were happy to publish that book. With Carpentaria, Terrier, because it was so different, and it was a big manuscript, and, written by an Aboriginal person, totally about an Aboriginal world, where, all Aboriginal people starred in the book, as characters. At a time of the Howard government, where there was a real dumbing down of throughout the country of ideas and expression, and that also carried into the publishing industry as well. That they wanted to publish very easy books to read and about non-Indigenous ideas, and so they weren't interested in the manuscript for Carpentaria, and like I said, it was a big manuscript as well, and totally different to what they wanted or felt was right as in Australian literature, and so they rejected it, and one publisher did have a look at the manuscript, actually wanted to publish it, but what the way they wanted to do it, I felt was to mainstream the book, and I felt that would kill it, and kill the whole book, and it wouldn't. It just didn't felt right because I put a lot of thought into that book. I wanted to be authentic in every possible way to my home country in the Gulf of Carpentaria, the way people talk, what we believed, what the country was about, and stories that were important to us. And to write it in a different sort of way, in that sort of a narrative voice of old Aboriginal men, say, for instance, speaking, was not kind of hip or sexy in the in the publishing world at that time in the Howard government, I can tell you. And I had the courage in the end to say no, you couldn't change the style of the book, and so they immediately dropped it, even though they had the book for a couple of years, the manuscript.
I was just going to say, Alexis, it really frustrates me to hear how hard a time you had trying to get it published and how they wanted to change it, because when you consider the really sort of the best-selling works that have a lot of Aboriginal themes, I'm thinking like The Secret River, where Aboriginal characters are completely voiceless. I mean, it just seems that even the publishing industry has got such a long way to go, even though you broke down those barriers to an extent. I think they're still so unwilling to even give Aboriginal people or let Aboriginal people have that voice in their own terms and not in a white way.
Mm. Yeah, no, that happens, and that's and it happens, and it continues to happen. Yes, that's right.
How'd you get it published then, with being rejected?
A friend of mine who's a writer asked Ivor Indick, who has an independent publishing company in Sydney, Giramondo Publishing. He asked him to have a look at the manuscript, And I have a suggest he'd have a look, and I didn't think he'd be interested, because I actually thought, you know, I'd end up archiving the manuscript with my land council up there, the Gulf of Carpentaria Land Council, with people like Murrin doing that, and just leave it for another day. And anyway, Ivor he read the manuscript. He sent me an email. I was still up in Alice Springs then, and asked a whole lot of questions, which were basically, why did I write this book the way I wrote it? And so I just sent him answers back, you know, and told him the reasons why, and to do with the authenticity of the work. And but I thought, oh, that would be the last I hear from him. He's got to get his return for whatever he publishes. He's only a small publisher. Anyway, he said no, he would publish it, and that was good. And he ended up publishing it, and that's what happened to it.
Very good.
It won the awards that it did, and it's been published, published in many different countries. And
wow, this goes to show. You only need one person to sort of see through.
That's it, we do find friends, and that's what I found with, my work, particularly in those early days, that you'd find one good person somewhere in the world, who would take up the challenge, like my French publisher, who'd just say, yes, I'll publish that, and I can really understand, where our writing is coming from many different parts of the world, not just, the English-speaking world as you know it, and just take up that challenge to publish. And so, but
what do you do between books? I mean, you got a day job, or you got something that keeps you busy, or just continually developing ideas or trying to document your thoughts and ideas and things for the next book? What do you do?
Well, look, I try to make that my day job.
Yeah, right.
As best I can.
Yeah.
What I've been doing for the last 3 years is until early this year, I was working with Tracker Tilmouth until passed away early this year to develop his essayed memoir. And that's what I've been working on all year, to bring together this huge book, huge manuscript so far, of ideas and thoughts and challenges, from someone like Tracker, who was really, statesman in a lot of ways. That one of major statesmen who, really challenged everybody with his ideas and with the things that he tried to do in his lifetime, and really in his thoughts about building an Aboriginal economy. Mm. From us, to us, for us, and for our future. And he was just hitting his straps with doing this. And so that's basically what I'm working on at the moment. And I was lucky enough to get an ARC fellowship to do that work. And so the book, the manuscript on 50 pages of completing.
Oh wow, wow. That'll be really good to read.
The draft manuscript, which is about 1,400 pages.
Wow.
I'm really glad, because we don't know our history and we don't know the sacrifices a lot of our elders actually went through, and I think that's sorely lacking. So many of our elders are passing away, and you never actually find out. You only really harness their story and the oral tradition, and it's nice to know that it's going to be written.
Yes. It'd probably be cut down a bit, for publication. But this larger manuscript exists, so that's a really good thing as far as I'm concerned, because it's so rich in of the times of what people tried to do, particularly someone like Tracker, and things that he accomplished and the difficulties and why there were so many difficulties, thrown against, the ideas, of art, what we tried to push. And and some of the major things that he achieved, and great thinking, you know, not many people like him.
That's for sure. Yes.
And it's going to be a great book, I think. You know, I'm just feel really privileged that I've been able to work on this. Really privileged.
Got a publisher in the wings waiting to have a look at this, or what's the story of the publisher?
Take up this challenge.
Right.
That's the next challenge.
Well, you've seen a Miles Franklin come, so you know, you just never know, eh?
Yeah, and I've been working on another novel, and that's completed in draft, and but I need to do some more work on that to finish it. And I think I'll be writing for the next few years. I think I'll be able to do that. I just got a fellowship from the Sydney Meyer Creative Fellowship, and it runs for 2 years. So I think I can stretch that into the next 3 or 4 years. And that will keep me busy at my desk, writing and thinking and trying to do something with it. And when you're talking about storytelling, Amy, what I've been wanting to do, and I'd like to see happen, to build a storytelling centre.
That'd be amazing.
In the Gulf of Carpentaria, and where it's, it's positioned and governed by ourselves on the ground, people like Murrindu up there, and it's a storytelling centre where we can get stories, you know, archived, and it could work across the country, but be good to be able to set it up, you know, from the ground up and see how it goes, and perhaps, you know, have quarterly essays, you know, that sort of publication, a quarterly essay, that we have our own quarterly essay in voice, and so that anybody can get online and listen to it. You know, people from some of our really, you know, voices from some of our really important people, you know, from country, you know, on some remote communities, talking about what they think is really important, and also the ability to archive all of our stories, because that's...
And have ownership over that, isn't it? Because researchers come in and take, you know, it'd be great.
Mm, mm. That's right, because, and I mean, it's marvellous what you do, you know, on your program, a lot of times, you know, we don't get the chance to do the books that we want to do on our elders,
yeah,
and people who are important, and they come and go, and we lose all that, and we've got to think of ways of stopping that from happening. So that's what I'd like to see happen, and that's what I'll try and work on too in the next few years.
There's just one last question I wanted to ask Alexis, and it's sort of my own personal question, because after I read the Swan book, I was one of the ones who absolutely loved it. But I was really interested in the character of Warren Finch. He ends up being the first Aboriginal president of Australia, but I thought it said a lot about the way Aboriginal politics is running currently in this country. And I was wondering whether you had anyone in mind when you actually wrote that character of Warren Finch.
Not really. Although there were a lot of examples around.
I kept having like an amalgamation of a couple of people, probably the main two when I was reading it.
Yeah, we're not lost for some of the craziness that goes on in our world, and it's not anyone in particular, but I have to admit that we do see a lot of things happening in our world, and it leads to great creativity.
I guess you can't say on radio anyway if it was based on anyone. But yeah, I really love the Swan book. I thought it was one of the best things I've ever read, actually. And unfortunately, I haven't read Carpentaria yet, so I think I'd have to set aside a full few months to read it. But I'm really excited to talk to you today, and I really appreciate you giving us the time as well.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you, Tiger. I've really appreciated it too, and really nice to be asked to to talk on your show.
It's been very good talking to you, giving us your time, and we certainly look forward to more of your stories, more of your writings and views and things.
Especially Tracker Tillmouth's memoir. I think that'll be really good.
Especially that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You
have a
great day.
Have a good day.
Righto. Bye now.
See ya.
Yeah. Alexis Wright, a one-year woman, Miles Franklin Award winner, an amazing woman.
Yeah, there's only been two Aboriginal Miles Franklin Award winners. The first one was Kim Scott, and he shared it with Thea Astley, or Tay Astley, I don't know how to say it, a couple of years ago. But then Alexis is the first Aboriginal woman and the first Aboriginal person to win it outright.
Mm.
And I think the Swan book was nominated again for a Miles Franklin, but Carpentaria is her real masterpiece, I reckon. But, yeah, it's a really complex, important work and, yeah, very different way of writing, I think. And, yeah, it's exciting to have people like her.
Certainly is. It certainly is. And the next book, like she says, and you say there, Tracker Tillmouth, I mean, he was a very smart man. He had ideas and things and plans that...
But you know who I was thinking of when we were talking to Alexis? It was Uncle Ross Watson,
right. Yeah,
and the River Story, because that's a very... another Aboriginal story that, you know, probably wouldn't be published or seen by a lot of white Australians.
Mm.
But we played it here on our program. It's very similar, I think, to what Alexis is doing in Carpentaria.
For sure, yeah. All right, Amy, it's close to time for... news time, end of the program. We're back tomorrow. Make sure you'll join us tomorrow on your local First Nation station for Let's Talk.